HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 373, recorded live Thursday, May 23rd, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at TELERIK.com. And by Franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at GesturePak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Mark Rendell about making the change from desktop to web development.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I've got my buddy Mark Rendell on the phone from England. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Lovely, lovely. You and I always have these kind of spirited discussions slash arguments. I like to call them lowercase a arguments. And you have been a desktop guy for a long time. I mean, what now, 20 years?
Yeah, and counting.
And you do like C, and you did C and C++. I mean, you really made the desktop sing.
Yeah. I was doing Unix applications back in at the start of the 90s, and then went through Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 and all those things, with lots of different languages, did some MFC work, did some VB work, used to use something called Gupta SQL Windows, mm-hmm. Which is, dead now and probably for the best. And then up through Windows Forms, and then WPF and Silverlight, and so yeah, hardcore desktop developer. Didn't really think that web apps had much to offer the world.
Yeah, and web apps were documents effectively for a very, very long time, and even until recently, it was just like you click and then the entire page refreshes. So you're basically kind of reading this book and going from page to page to page. And I always say that Gmail is when we kind of first noticed, or maybe Outlook Web Access was when things started to change. And you said, hey, this could be an app.
Yeah.
You were still not convinced.
No, it was just the fact that you loaded an application on your desktop and it's loaded and then it's pulling data and doing interesting things with it and generating graphs or exporting data and interacting with Office and all the other things you've got on your desktop. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't see how web applications could compete with that mm-hmm. until quite recently. It is the last couple of years.
You were in Build 2011 still arguing against JavaScript itself.
I was, although... funnily enough, I went off, so they handed out the slates Build, and I went off to my hotel that evening and wrote an application in C# and XAML. But as I got more into working with building Windows 8 apps, I actually started writing the non-UI code in C#, and using the async await and all that good stuff. But I started doing the UIs in HTML. Mm-hmm. Just because I found it easier to work with CSS for doing the responsive screen and when you went snapped into different states and that sort of thing. Having been quite a fan of XAML for quite a long time, I suddenly got into doing things with HTML and CSS, and I just thought, actually, for describing a UI, this does appear to be better in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly a responsive one. I think that's the thing that, you know, XAML is just ridiculously powerful, almost to the point where the on-ramp to XAML is pretty steep, you know, to really be good.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the on-ramp to HTML is more shallow. Certainly both of them ratchet up pretty quickly, in their difficulty, but the initial on-ramp to XAML is pretty hardcore.
It is, and particularly with the whole MVVM and when you get into the needing to write your application in such a way that a designer can come along with Blend and work with just the XAML and not with the underlying code. And so you've got kind of mock data contexts or whatever else is going on. And when you get into theming and styling with XAML, that whole side of things, which is still in XAML, is really scary compared to CSS.
Because there's no CSS for XAML.
No, there's just more XAML. And it's just XAML piled on top of XAML, and you get kind of resource dictionaries and resource dictionaries referencing other resource dictionaries.
So we don't want to pile on XAML, but what I think is the interesting story here is your kind of personal transformation. And it's not about quitting one thing and jumping all in on the other, you know, although those kinds of stories are always interesting. This is more of a, you really just didn't think that the web was nearly as useful as most people did. You were desktop and desktop till the end.
Yeah, I honestly, a year and a half ago, I could not have seen myself becoming a web developer. And that was partly just thinking it's not mature enough to build proper applications, and however far it catches up, desktop tools and WPF and XAML and all these things are going to stay two or three steps ahead of it. But just the last year or so, and HTML5 is getting more and more support, and IE9 had a lot of improvements. Then IE10 came along, and IE10 Metro in the Windows 8 tablets, and I just started to think, you know, maybe you can actually do something useful here, and started investigating the tools. And once I started investigating the tools and the frameworks that were available, it was more, okay, wow, there's some really cool stuff here. You can actually do really great things with this.
Does this make you think the desktop is dead? Because like I say, people always go, you know, back and forth with these things. They'll declare that, oh, well, this is clearly, you know, the desktop is going to die. Now the web is all there is. But then something on the desktop will happen that's so amazing that no one can believe it, you know, and then we'll bring the metronome back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm currently waiting until I have enough money in the bank to buy a new full tower desktop computer, just because I want something with a NVIDIA graphics card and all that sort of stuff. And there are things that I still think for a long time are going to be the domain of the desktop, if for no other reason than data transfer and bandwidth for a lot of people isn't at the point yet where you can kind of just quickly load up a 1 gigabyte raw image file that you've taken with your 50 megapixel camera. And load that into the browser and start working with it. So, you know, Adobe Creative Cloud, it might be called Creative Cloud, but it's still a bunch of desktop applications. And I can't see Photoshop becoming a browser-based application for a while. But I can see, within the next 5 to 10 years, Visual Studio becoming a browser-based application. And obviously Word and Excel and PowerPoint already have browser-based applications, and they do most of the things that the desktop versions do.
Yeah, it's not an unreasonable kind of leap of logic if you think about it. The Outlook web application is really amazing, you know, especially the new one if you've used the Office 365.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I
hate to say it, but I sometimes find myself using the web version of Outlook just because it's lighter weight than the desktop one.
Yeah.
It's just a little faster.
It is, and it gets you there quicker. And I just find myself more and more these days where I look down at my taskbar and the only things open are the browsers. And kind of wishing, actually, that some of the things that are down there were in the browser.
Although still we don't want a Chromebook, though. Isn't that funny? We all say, isn't it wonderful that we only run the browser and then one or two apps? And then when we are given a computer that runs only the browser, we're like, yeah, not so much.
Yeah. It's nice to know that on those times when my cable company manages to completely disconnect broadband for an evening, I can still do most things on my computer. Can't play SimCity, obviously, but I can do most things. So yeah, you know, but it's increasing. It's kind of switched the other way. So where I used to think there's the desktop application and then the web version is the lightweight alternative. Now I'm thinking there's the web application and the desktop is the heavyweight alternative when there's something that I can't do in the browser app for whatever reason that might be. I mean, Spotify is a great example. I've got a Windows 8 machine and there are issues with the Spotify desktop application on Windows 8, depending on what drivers you've got and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I have that running in a Chrome tab and it's fine. And it does everything that the desktop application does. And Spotify doesn't work offline anyway. So, you know, even if you've got the desktop application, it's still not caching things locally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just more and more and more. And you look at some of the things that some people are doing. So, I mean, the browser-based Office 365 applications are one example. I don't know if you've played much with Cloud9 IDE.
Yeah,
you do a lot of node work.
Yeah, it that's the thing that makes you believe that maybe you could, in fact, do Visual Studio on the cloud.
Yeah. And I mean, I would probably be thinking about trying to do a C#.NET IDE in the browser if it wasn't for the fact that Microsoft are currently pushing things on a visualstudio.com domain, which makes me think, maybe that's going to happen anyway and I don't want to waste too much time on it.
Well, like the new TFS stuff all runs at visualstudio.com and you can have like your own domain. You can have your own subdomains. Like I have hanselman.visualstudio.com.
Yeah. I mean, I've got my stuff in there. I'm using the Git service in it rather than the TFS service, but I'm pretty much the only person who works on my code, and Git's got a much nicer workflow for a single user than TFS.
No, I think when I say TFS, I'm not talking about the source control. TFS, the issue tracking and all that stuff. I use Git too.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. So, but no, I was going to say the browser-based TFS, for various reasons, I use TFS in Firefox because I use it with a different live ID than I use in my other browsers.
Mm-hmm.
But the browser-based tools for the task board, the Kanban board, and just the general overview are way better because you get like an entire browser window instead of that little Team Explorer sidebar, which is trying to cram all that information in. And, you know, editing story cards and moving things across and all this sort of stuff is in the browser. You've got this lovely GUI story. Whereas in Visual Studio, it doesn't seem to be quite the same.
The thing that I find the most frustrating when I'm doing work on the web is I still don't feel like the debugging story is quite there. You know, I find myself in Visual Studio and I'm doing stuff and then I run over into Chrome or into IE and I hit F12 and I struggle to really understand what the heck's going on in JavaScript. Like, I feel like there's an opportunity to kind of disrupt things with a much better experience for explaining what exactly is going on right now, you know?
I think so. I think some of that's down to JavaScript as a language and the fact that it's dynamic and so there's a limit to how much information you can have while you're debugging through it in the browser. The thing that really annoys me with the debugging experience is that there are things that each of the three browsers I use does really well.
Right.
And I just think, why can't Chrome do IE's Quick Watch and the stuff that's built in for inspecting variables? I don't like the way Chrome does the variable inspection. IE's is more like Visual Studio's, so that works for me. But at the same time, why isn't IE's F12 developer tools extensible?
Right.
And then over in Firefox, it's not Firefox, it's Firebug. And
right.
You install that, and there's some really great stuff in there, but they're not. It's not deeply integrated into the browser. And also, it's having to update itself every however often it is. But have you had a chance to play with SourceMap debugging in Chrome with TypeScript?
Yeah, in fact, I have, because if you've played with VS Web Essentials, Mads Christensen's playground for our ASP.NET labs, he'll make source maps for you with anything. So you can actually right-click in the Solution Explorer and minify stuff. And then, of course, with TypeScript, you can just --/ source maps, and it'll spit source maps out when you do your compilation at the command line. I actually end up putting that in my CS proj, so that stuff happens on build.
Yes, I have a pre-build step that does a tsc.exe across all my TypeScript files. But it's one of the things with the IE team and their longer release cadence than Chrome and Firefox is you don't get these advances coming in. And because the F12 developer tools aren't extensible.
Meaning that that IE does not have source map control support yet.
No. So there are, basically, for when you're working with TypeScript, you've got two options. One is to debug in Visual Studio, which it works, but it doesn't feel particularly natural.
Right, but let's back up a moment and just give people an understanding about what source maps are and why we should care about them.
Okay, so source maps are like a PDB file for JavaScript that you've either generated by compiling another language, like TypeScript or CopyScript or Clojure, or when you have passed your JavaScript through a minifier and turned it into a single unreadable line of randomness, and a source map will link bits of either that JavaScript or that minified file back to the line of source code that it originally came from. And if you're using Chrome debugger tools, or for TypeScript, if you're working in Visual Studio 2012 with the TypeScript plugin, you can you still have to set the breakpoint in the JavaScript, but when it breaks, it goes to the TypeScript file that JavaScript was compiled from. And then you can step debug through the TypeScript. So you hit F10 and it goes to the next line of TypeScript, and you can view the TypeScript variables and all that sort of thing. Which obviously, you know, a couple of years ago you were talking about JavaScript as the assembly language for the web. But one of the big issues with it was that, CoffeeScript's been big for a couple of years. But when people were trying to work out why their CoffeeScript wasn't working, they were having to step debug through the JavaScript and then try and work out how to fix that in the CoffeeScript. Or if you were me, instinctively fixing it in the JavaScript and then overwriting that the next time you did a build. So now you have source maps, and you can actually you can break that divide in the same way that, you know, as desktop native programmers or C# programmers, you don't have to step debug through the bytecode. You can link it back to the C# that it came from and inspect things there.
Right. Because web applications have or reasonably sized ones have this idea of a release mode. And the configuration of the application that you work on in release mode is different from the debug mode one.
Yeah.
You know, for a small app, you could absolutely go and throw out your application exactly as you work on it. But when you put it into production, you minify things, you compress things, you change settings, you include all sorts of things in source maps or that bridge. And that's a killer feature. Like, you have to have that. And if you're going to start using something like TypeScript or CoffeeScript and you want to debug back to the original, it's so important to have. And if IE's developer tools were written in JavaScript, presumably we would be able to extend them.
Yes. I don't know what Google's, what Chrome's developer tools are written in, but one of my longtime bugbears with IE is that it's not particularly extensible, which is a shame.
But what have you built? What is this? This is not holding you back, apparently. Like, what have you built that is comparable to a desktop application now that has got you so stoked about the web?
So I've spent the last year and a half, nearly, building Zudio, which is Azure storage management tool that's done entirely in the browser, in HTML5 and At runtime, it's JavaScript, but when I'm building it, it's a few thousand lines of TypeScript split across 40-odd files. And it's very strange. I have my web application, which has got controllers folder and all the sort of server-side stuff. And then there's also an app folder, which has got all my TypeScript inside it. And inside there, I've got the same thing for the client side. So I've got a controllers and a services folder and all these TypeScript files that spread across all these things. Mm-hmm. And then I have a build process that combines them all together and minifies them and everything. The fact that the only tools that were available for managing Azure storage were desktop applications was frustrating me. At first, because I wanted to be able to use my iPad, and then various other tablets and phones, and things. And then because you have licensing that says you can only use this on two machines, otherwise you have to buy another license, and I have a lot of computers that I have access to. I thought, let's see if I can build that as a web application. I originally thought I'm going to do an iPad application for working with Azure storage, but then I thought, well, that's all very well, but Android and other things, and then Windows 8 tablet coming along. So I thought I'd try and do it as a web app. Started the first time through using a third-party kind of controls library for JavaScript, and jQuery and Knockout for binding and so forth, and got one third of the application written, and I was reasonably happy with it, but the code was a mess. And this was before TypeScript came along, and when you're writing JavaScript, unless you are very experienced and you've developed some good practices over the years, mm-hmm. You tend to end up with your JavaScript all over the place, and some of it's in script tags and some of it's in that file over there. And because there is no formal build process, I could never really find a way of getting my JavaScript organized.
I see. So phrased differently, as I've said before, the idea that compilation is the first unit test. I was talking last week with Brian from Lucidchart, and he was telling me that they use Clojure and write a whole bunch of JavaScript. Lucidchart is their kind of Visio for the web application. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, many, many thousands of lines of JavaScript. And he says that having this compilation step, or having, more specifically, having type checking, catches an entire class of errors that you just wouldn't catch otherwise. Like, even the best JavaScript person might have these errors just latent sitting there unless they have a lot of unit test coverage to catch them.
Yeah, and you can write unit tests that will catch these things, but you are writing unit tests just to catch type errors. And so if you can have a compiler that runs, and you can say to that compiler, okay, so any object that gets passed to this function has to have these three properties and could potentially have these other two, like you can with TypeScript interfaces, then rather than you having to go, well, what are the possible things that could happen and what could go wrong here and everything else, you can just go F6 and the compiler will just go, you idiot, you've left off the count property on this thing that you're trying to pass to a web service, which is blatantly not going to mm-hmm. work. Do it again, and then hit F6 again.
But why isn't that different from just using like JSLint?
Because JSLint doesn't know about types. It will pick up things like missing semicolons, and you can get it to pick up. I prefer JSHint to JSLint because JSHint doesn't tell me that I haven't laid out my code right. Yeah, JSHint will say, if you use double equals there, and you probably meant to use a triple equals and things like that. But it can't tell if you've got a chain of functions, what the shape of the objects that are being passed between those functions should be. So it can't pick up type errors because it's working with a dynamic language. And what TypeScript does is it says for all of these functions, I can basically just annotate the parameters and say this needs to be this interface or this is a string. And then if I try and call a function that's expecting a string and try and pass a bean in there, then it'll tell me about it. I've had people who question the usefulness of this, and I just try and point them to the number of times every day I hit F6 and have errors, type errors in my TypeScript. Maybe it's just because I suck.
It might be why.
Yeah, you know, I need to have my hand held by the compiler and stop me from making stupid mistakes. It's possibly a luxury tool. It's possibly just a nice thing to have, but it makes me more productive. It makes me less likely to release code into the wild that is going to say object not defined or property not found. And particularly since my target market is largely web developers, these are the guys who, if there's an error in the JavaScript, it's not going to show a little yellow triangle down in. It's going to throw up a huge great dialog box saying, debug this. And they're going to go, yes! So, yeah, having TypeScript in there is, I think it's really accelerated my journey to the dark side or light side, depending on your point of view.
And do you think that this is something that's going to become more mainstream? I mean, like, there are those that find TypeScript or CoffeeScript or Clojure or whatever, and they say, this is it. I found it. This is what I need to be doing. And then there are others who just say, no, always get back to the, there's almost a get back to the metal kind of renaissance right now around JavaScript.
Yes.
Like we're all learning assembler, right?
Yeah.
We're all learning assembler, and now it's time to, move to C. And the assembler folks are like, I don't really know. I kind of like assembler. It's important to know assembler.
Yeah. I like the C++ guys arguing with the C guys, and the C guys going, your objects and your pre-compiler stuff and all this nonsense. You just need structs and functions and get on with it. I think some of the evolutions in the JavaScript language that they're currently talking about with ECMAScript 6 are good, and TypeScript actually just gives you a lot of those now in a way that compiles to JavaScript until JavaScript catches up, and then it'll just go, I'll just leave that there. I think the backlash is more against, I was talking to someone earlier about this today, it's more against the libraries, and particularly I think jQuery is getting a hard time at the moment. And I have to say, you just drag jQuery on to your HTML files, your CSHTML files, without even thinking about it. And you just use $paren, hash something or dot something, because it's just there. And you forget that it's not part of the language. I actually had a guy report an issue with Zoodio, where the landing page came up, and it loads the landing page very quickly, does the layout very quickly. And he was clicking the login button, and it wasn't working for like 4 seconds because it was downloading jQuery so that jQuery could say dot login button, dot on click, or whatever it was. And it's just, I hadn't thought about it. And so... that was the only thing. I was downloading a 50K file into people's browsers so that I could add a click event handler to a button. And it's just kind of, I don't think I really need to do that. I can rewrite that with query element all and just add a click handler with the add event listener. And so, yeah, I think I had to write 3 extra lines of code over what was already there.
Right.
And eliminated kind of a 50K download for people.
But you had to think.
But yeah, I just hadn't thought about it. And I think that's the backlash, is people including jQuery so they don't have to think rather than including jQuery for what jQuery was originally intended for, which was to cover the disparities between different browsers' implementations of the DOM and the JavaScript models and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, and even jQuery 2.0, I think they've knocked 19K off the file size by dropping support for the older browsers.
Right.
But it's still big. And it's still, you know, do you really need it? I think that's the backlash. I think there are the newer, the big kind of MVW frameworks like AngularJS, which is what I'm using, Backbone and Ember and so forth, those, and Knockout and Breeze, those are actually bringing a level of convenience and helpfulness and helping you do stuff that would take a very long time to do in vanilla JavaScript. And so I don't think anyone's saying, stop using them for building these big applications. I think it's just stop using jQuery for everything. Stop putting the dollar there all the time. Not stop using jQuery altogether, but just think about it.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got one jQuery call in your entire application, maybe you should rewrite it just using JavaScript.
I definitely think there's a maturity that is coming soon. I think that we are all writing assembler and we are used to using different libraries. So we're going to kind of thrash for a little bit as we try to figure out what exactly this thing that we're building wants to become. And then go to whatever the next step is.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But, I mean, all I know is that I spent the last 6 months having got to the kind of point where I had unmanageable, unmaintainable code in JavaScript and various other things. I basically threw most of the code away, rewrote the whole of Zudio from scratch in TypeScript and AngularJS, and using Twitter's Bootstrap components. Mm-hmm. And I have not had this much fun coding for a very long time. I think since I first found C#. So when I went from what I was on to C#, it was like, this is the best language ever. And I don't have to delete my objects and all this sort of thing. And yeah, working with TypeScript, with HTML and CSS and the Bootstrap components, and with AngularJS, which is, I think it's the holy grail of data binding. It is so good at working out that you change something 15 levels down in an object hierarchy and just reflecting that in the browser screen. And yeah, it's just awesome. And I'm having a really great time. And having fun just churning this code out and building something that is in the browser and doing things that I didn't think browsers could do a couple of years ago. So, yeah.
So where can people see your application in closing? Where can they go and see this, what you're working on in the real world?
You can go to zud.io. Because when you're doing a cloud tool like this, you have to have a .io domain. You can sign up for a free trial now. If you're using Azure Storage, Blobs, Tables, or Queues, then just sign in with your Windows Live ID. It'll start you a 30-day free trial. And then when that runs out, I'm going to give you a discount code for Handsome Linux listeners. So they're just going to be able to go along and put HM20 in, which will give them 20% off a one-year subscription after their free trial.
That's very kind. Cool. Thanks for doing that.
Well, you know, I suspect that this is going to be a good way to get people who will tell me what's wrong with it.
No, that's great.
But it's, I've been using it. I've been dog fooding it all the way through building it. Mm-hmm. It's what I use now every day. And I think it's, I'm really proud of it. I think it's a good example of what you can do with just one guy and 6 months as a web application. And I've got a lot of plans to expand on it, put new features and other things. So, yeah, I hope people...
Another episode of Handsome Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.